Welcome to the Center for Science, Technology, and Society podcast. The Social Entrepreneurship Action Research Roundtables, presented by the Global Social Benefit Fellows. Social entrepreneurship. Girls, they run the world.
Hello, and thank you for coming for today's presentation. Today, we will be discussing women and social entrepreneurship. The student presenters are Kevin Cosell, Lauren Rebels, Natalie Lays, and Lauren Fairwell. As Global Social Benefit Fellows, these students have been involved with a nine-month program involving travel this past summer to work with a social enterprise in a developing country. Kevin traveled to Uganda to work with Solar Sister, Kiva, and Agaza Design, although the majority of his work was with Solar Sister, a company that eradicates energy poverty by empowering women through economic activity. In Zambia, Laura worked with Lifeline Energy and Chikuni Parish, Tuanga, researching interactive radio instruction schools and learning about the effects of energy poverty. Natalie traveled to Brazil to work with Solar Ear, a social enterprise that manufactures low-cost solar-powered hearing aids. Laura spent the summer in India working for Ani Deep, a nonprofit that provides training for marginalized youth and women in IT skills, English language, and workplace readiness, and its for-profit sister enterprise, iMerit, which hires IUD graduates and digital jobs delivering web-based projects for global customers. The format of this presentation will have discussions after each speaker, so don't hesitate to participate. Thank you, guys, and we will begin.
So to start us off, we have some facts about women in the world to kind of make this issue a little bit more real. So the first is that women are half the world's population, working two-thirds of the world's working hours, receiving 10% of the world's income, and owning less than 1% of the world's property.
Every day, approximately 800 women die from preventable causes related to childbirth, and 99% of this happens in the developing world.
780 million women and children breathe kerosene fumes, inhaling the equivalent of smoke from two packs of cigarettes a day.
And 53% of the world's out-of-school children are girls, and two-thirds of the illiterate people in the world are women.
So as we started this group project, we were brainstorming ideas as to what empowerment means, but specifically in the developing world and specifically with women. So we've come up with what we are going to consider empowerment to be during the course of this presentation, and it kind of has five different components that we want to put out on the table for you right at the beginning. So one aspect of women empowerment is a woman's sense of self-worth and finding her intrinsic value. She also has a right to have and determine choices, access to opportunities and resources. Women have a right to have the power to control their own lives, both within their home and outside of their home, and the ability to influence social change and to create a more just social economic order, both nationally and internationally. So with these guidelines in place, we want to explore why they're not being met. So basically, why are women today still disempowered?
So I'd like to just give a quick history lesson about pre-colonial Nigeria. So back in Nigeria, before the British colonists arrived, they had a dual-sex political system, which means women and men had equal decision-making power and authority. And the leaders were the Obi for the men and the Omu for the women, which means mother in the Igbo language. And it was kind of like a monarchy, but the women didn't derive their power from the men's rule. It was actually vice versa, with most of the societies having matrilineal inheritance and matriarchal rule. And then when British colonists arrived, they stripped the women of all their authority and decision-making power and only referenced the men when it came to making important decisions for the societies in Africa. And then when Nigeria gained their independence and the British colonists left, they restored the position of the Omu, but it never reached its original glory. And so I think that shows that at the heart of African culture, that women are they're valued very highly, and if you look at society today, you just wouldn't see that.
As we're going to explore in this presentation, there's lots of different contributing factors to the disempowerment of women, but we're going to focus on four specifically. The first being maternal mortality and access to healthcare, energy poverty, education, and income earning opportunities. So that's what we're choosing to hone in on. So I'm going to start by addressing the current state of maternal health in much of the developing world. So one of the 8 Millennium Development Goals that were designed by the United Nations is to improve maternal health by 2015, and they're hoping to reduce the ratio of maternal mortality by 3/4. And although a lot of progress has been made in this area specifically, in the developing region, the death during childbirth is still 15 times higher than in the developed world. So to start off, what is causing this high rate of maternal mortality? So if you take a look at these graphs, I want you to focus in on the sky blue with the arrows pointing to it. And so as you can see, that's the highest portion of maternal mortality, and that's hemorrhage, which is basically just a loss of blood. And I found this interesting because it's not necessarily a really complicated medical issue that requires, you know, a highly skilled physician to be on site during the pregnancy. It's really just kind of a simple and very preventable cause of death during childbirth. And so that just goes to show that there's lots of potential in investing in this particular problem because it's very preventable and can have large impacts. Also, indoor and outdoor air pollution can contribute to the mortality rate. So as the primary cook in a family is the woman, and so she's often exposed to many fumes, and this can these contain a large number of hazardous pollutants that can lead to respiratory infections after birth. And also preterm births are very frequently found in the developing world, and this can be the result of poor nutrition during pregnancy, being underweight, or stressful life events. So all these factors are ongoing and contributing to the mortality rate. But what can be done about it? Because there's lots that can be done about it. So for one thing, if we can reduce the number of teenage pregnancies, because teenage pregnancies are a large portion of deaths that are related to childbirth. So every day, just some statistics to put in perspective, every day 20,000 girls below the age of 18 give birth in developing countries. And girls aged 15 to 19 are twice as likely as older women to die from causes related to pregnancy and childbirth. And furthermore, their babies, studies have shown, were 50% more likely to die than children who were born of women in their 20s. And the youngest mothers, those 14 and under, face the greatest risk. So research that's been done in Bangladesh showed that the risk of maternal mortality was 5 times higher for women aged 10 to 14 when compared to women aged 20 to 24. And also, when we talk about teenage pregnancies, obstructed labor, is the most common cause of death during pregnancy. And furthermore, specifically in sub-Saharan Africa, the transmission of HIV is much more likely from mother to child during teenage pregnancies. So one way to reduce this rate is to try to prevent teenage pregnancies. Another way is to empower women to seek out family planning services and space the births of their children. So this may seem like kind of common knowledge for us as women in the U.S., but in a lot of developing countries, women may not necessarily have the resources to plan the number of children they have or they may not be empowered to decide when they want to have their children. So 2 summers ago, I found this to be true when I was in Kenya. I was working in a medical clinic, and the most frequent visits were women who were coming in seeking out family planning because they didn't want to have as many kids as maybe their husband wanted to have. And even if maybe in some cases they didn't have the resources to get family planning, or in other cases they didn't feel empowered enough to go out and seek those resources on their own. So if we can make this more available to women, that can really help their situation. And then perhaps the most obvious way we can help with this maternal mortality is to ensure that there's trained attendants at pregnancies, even in rural areas in the developing world. So one social enterprise that is really making huge strides in helping the situation that women face during childbirth is We Care Solar. And it's actually founded by a woman in the Bay Area who traveled to northern Nigeria in 2000. And she was seeing a huge rate of maternal mortality, and she wanted to do something about it. And the biggest problem she saw was that many women were giving birth in the dark, whether it was at night or whether when the electricity went out, because it's very unreliable. So she saw pregnancies and C-sections that were being done by candlelight or even by the light of a cell phone. They'd be in the middle of a delivery and electricity would go out, or they'd be giving birth at night and there'd be no source of light. So Laura, the co-founder, designed what's called like a solar suitcase. And so it's economical, it's easy to use, it's portable, durable, and it's this kind of self-contained unit that provides healthcare workers with highly efficient medical lighting, as well as power to charge other mobile devices and to power other medical devices. And so this was monumental in reducing the number of deaths related to childbirth, because now these deliveries could be done in the light, but more importantly, in reliable light, because you know you can't always predict the timing of your pregnancy. And so women who are now giving birth at night had a much better chance of maintaining their health. So in addition to specifically maternal mortality, I also want to talk about another Millennium Development Goal, which is just to achieve universal access to reproductive health. So as of right now, only half of women in developing regions receive the recommended amount of health care each year. But one success story that I want to focus on is in Eritrea, a country which once had the highest maternal mortality ratio in the world. And this was due to a number of factors. It was a very rural community. It had poor communication and transportation infrastructure. So about 80% of deliveries were taking place without a physician or a trained midwife present. But today, it's one of 4 African countries that are actually on track to meet the Millennium Development Goal. So it's reduced the deaths related to childbirth from 1,400 to just 350 for every 100,000 births. So it's really, really made great strides. And this is because they've really intensified maternal health campaigns, local language training, and they've trained in local areas so that there's always somebody on site at the present of birth who knows the language and is prepared. So the World Health Organization has put out a report about the socioeconomic benefits of investing in women's health. And I just want to go through some of the most important points that they have stated. So the first, when a mother thrives, the children are better fed and better educated. And when the mother becomes sick or even dies after birth, children are more likely to be sent to foster care where they are exposed to various health risks and neglect and perhaps minimal resources. And studies have shown that when women are the primary income earners, they are more likely than men to spend their earnings on goods and services that benefit the whole household. So Lauren has a story to really make that point clear.
Yeah, so when I was in Calcutta, we made friends with a student named Musaral, and she was 20 years old, so kind of our age, and she had recently been employed by iMerit in an IT job. And in her community, it was normal to be making about 1,000 rupees per month for the entire family, because the men in the household are the primary income earners. However, with her job, she was earning now 5,000 per month, which is more than her dad, more than her brother. And with her income, she chose to pay for her own college tuition in addition to her 2 brothers' college tuition. So that's an example of a woman reinvesting her earnings into the family for the well-being.
Yeah, and this past summer when I was in Brazil, we were working with an enterprise that makes low-cost solar-powered hearing aids, and when a woman received a hearing aid, she wasn't just receiving the ability to hear, but now she could, you know, hear her daughter when she was crying at night and could better take care of her children. So it's really this proliferation of effects. So that was really cool to get to see. So now I want to shift gears a little bit. I've been talking about how women can be the beneficiaries of a social enterprise like We Care Solar. But I also want to talk about how women can be directly involved in social enterprises. And to address that issue, I want to focus on one specific enterprise called Aravind Eye Care, which operates in India. And as of 2010, they were the largest provider of eye care. And their mission is simply to eliminate needless blindness. But the way in which women play into this is that the organization and staffing of the business has maximized the potential for women. One member of the team is a paramedic, and they only hire women as paramedics. And they, before they hire each woman, they kind of do, not really a background check, but they kind of hand select women who they think offer the most potential. And so oftentimes these women are from rural backgrounds, maybe a farmer's family, usually between the ages of 17 and 19. And they prefer to hire young women from large families because they know that once they employ this one woman, the benefits, the income that she makes will be proliferated to the rest of her family. And so it can impact even more people. But basically just by employing women, Aravind Eye Care is providing not only job security and a reliable income for the woman, but also for her whole family. So now I want to step back and consider, I've talked a lot about pouring resources and income into the health of a woman, so kind of somebody in an older generation. But maybe we should be focusing more on the children. So I want to ask you guys, do you think it's better to focus our resources on mothers and parents or on the children so that when they grow up, they will already be healthier and be more empowered? Basically, like, what should be the focus? Yeah, definitely. The mother can be a very powerful role model for the children. So that's a very good point. Any other ideas? Yeah, Miles.
So, the counter argument to that could be that if we start empowering the children when the women or children, when they become mothers, they can then set the example. So, I mean, you can look at it in both ways. You can set the example now and then have it spread to the children as well as spread it to the children. And then when they become mothers, they can then spread it to their children and you can start the generation, you know, changes there. But I think both ways could work. I don't see any objection to either way. I think the empowerment of the woman is still going to be increased if you help the mothers or if you help the children.
I definitely agree with both of you. I think just to kind of push the child aspect a little bit more, though, is one thing we saw in Zambia a lot is a lot of children are orphans, and they don't have a mother to implement those health practices, whether they're trained or not. And so one benefit of starting with and focusing more on the child would be to, for those who don't have mothers, to pass on that knowledge. That's something as well.
Okay, yeah, that's really good points. Obviously, I think that it's really important to invest in maternal health. Otherwise, I wouldn't have just been talking for the past 10 minutes. But there definitely are benefits of investing in the child. And so to explore that more, I'm going to hand it over to Laura.
All right. So I'm going to be looking at education, women in education. So why focus on education, especially the education of young girls? According to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, education is a human right. I think most of us in this room would agree that education is important. Some proven examples of the impact of education of women are that countries with greater gender equality are more likely to have higher economic growth. Educated women tend to be healthier, as Natalie pointed out, participate in more informal labor market, earn more income, have fewer children, and provide better health care and education to their children. Yet, in 2012, there were 30 million girls still out of school. In light of this, two of the UN's Millennium Development Goals reflect the desire to educate women. These goals are to ensure that by 2015, children everywhere, boys and girls alike, will be able to complete a full course of primary schooling, and to limit gender disparity in primary and secondary education, preferably by 2005, and in all levels of education no later than 2015. Now, I'm a really positive person, and so I still have hope that these goals can be accomplished, but if you think about it realistically, at the rate that it's been going, it's probably not going to happen by 2015. Governments and ministries of education have been working to various degrees on improving the education opportunities for students, especially young girls. For example, in Zambia, the Ministry of Education has created an educational broadcast called the Learning at Tango Market Program, which provides educational lessons to students. So they're called IRI schools, interactive radio instruction schools. And these provide lessons in math, science, language, all different varies of subjects. And they're taught by, the lessons are facilitated by someone called a mentor, someone who's been educated but is not necessarily a trained teacher. Sometimes these are mothers themselves who have had some formal schooling. I don't have a picture of this, I wish I did, but a lot of times they'll have their young infant child strapped to their back while they're teaching. So that's one opportunity that the government has created. Unfortunately, though, in Zambia, they cut the funding for this program recently, so it's no longer broadcast across the country. So I don't even know numbers specifically, but for so many students who had this access to education, when they wouldn't otherwise have access to a formal school setting because of financial constraints or maybe distance from school, they no longer have that without these radio schools. So there have been some social entrepreneurship enterprises who have stepped up to fill that gap that the government has been lacking there. For example, Lifeline Energy, who I worked with this summer, makes solar-powered and hand-crank radios that serve to provide fill the gap in educational opportunities. So one of their newest technologies is an MP3 radio, so you can preload content onto them and play them anywhere. So in Zambia, they could preload these Learning at Tango Market programs, and they could still offer them in areas of the country that no longer have the broadcast. So that solves the problem of access in some cases, but that doesn't necessarily get all the students in the door or provide them the quality education. If you really think about the goal is the way it's phrased, really gets at, oh, how many students can we get in the door? How many of them can we get them to complete grade 7, say? But does that really mean they're getting a quality education? And there are reasons there are different factors that are barriers to an education for students. That could be teacher absenteeism or abuse from teachers, which prevents students from getting a quality education. But a big thing might be just the students themselves don't want to go to school. When I was in El Salvador last year, I learned that the last grade that students are required to go to is third grade, which was just incredible to me. I have cousins that are that age, and I can't imagine them just being done with school. And so they just get a stop there. But if without the motivation, there's no reason for them to go on further. There was a study done in India that suggested that one way to motivate people to continue their education further was to invest in businesses that provide different income earning opportunities. And so they would require a specific labor force. So you would need to be trained in a specific skill to get that job, which would motivate students to continue their education longer. For young girls, this might be just the opportunity to have a job versus I'm going to be a housewife, so why would I need to continue my education? So my question for you is whether you think it would be wise, in light of the upcoming 2015 deadline of the Millennium Development Goals, do you think it would be wise for maybe both governments and social enterprises to focus more resources on creating job opportunities and businesses that require an educated labor force? Or do you think it's smart to keep going the route of putting money and putting resources into the education system and building that up?
I think one of the issues that we saw when we were in Zambia was that a lot of, particularly in the rural areas, is even when you do achieve primary education and succeed getting through grade 7, where are the opportunities after that? I mean, because they're in such a rural area, a lot of times, even if they were successful with the remedial schools and everything, there was no place for them to go after that. They would slide back into the same things that they had never even gotten education to begin with. So I think that, obviously they're both important, but maybe it's more a matter of reaching out and trying to, I guess I would be more on the side of increasing secondary education, mm-hmm. I suppose, rather than trying to create jobs that only work on primary education. But that's an interesting question.
One other question.
I can't say that we didn't see that, but I know that one of the major barriers that they had with, looking at their graduates that had gone through the programs, there was a good proportion of them that weren't able to make it back.
It's kind of going off what Jack said with the Learning and Tango Market program, it goes up to the 7th grade, so there's access for primary school, but then, like Jack's pointed out, then what are they going to do for high school? There isn't a radio broadcast education system for them in high school. And if they don't have access to that, then that's something. All right. So thinking of education, one thing that really can hinder the education of a student is their access to light at night to do homework. So moving on to that, Kevin's going to talk a little bit about solar.
So I worked with Solar Sister this past summer, and one thing we noticed with a lot of the women we interviewed were the benefits that their children saw from solar lights. And almost all the women we talked to, one of the first things they'd say is, now my children have access to light so that they can read and do homework at night. When generally they are either in school or busy during the day, by the time they get home, finish their chores, it's already dark, and they have to depend on a dim kerosene lamp that is not only dangerous but polluting the air. And so the benefits that solar unlocks are just you can't count them. It's amazing the potential that kids have once they have a solar light. And so I think solar really benefits families and women especially in numerous ways, one being safety of the children and the mothers. As we mentioned before, women are often given the duties of collecting firewood, and it's not readily available most of the time, so you need to travel long distances to get it. And walking long distances at night anywhere, especially in a developing country, is dangerous, and a solar light can make that a little less dangerous. And one woman in particular we talked to used a solar light just as an outdoor light in her home. And this may seem insignificant, and it may seem like something that we have here. We have street lights everywhere we walk, or just like a normal porch light is expected. But for them, having a light inside their home is a big step, and having an outdoor light can provide just an amazing amount of safety that is just so valuable to them that we don't see as an important step in improving improving their safety. And Laura actually was interviewing some people in her placement in Zambia, and she wanted to say something about this.
Yeah, so one of the questions we asked on our energy poverty survey that we did was, have you ever had any accidents as a result of using candles or kerosene in your home? And many people we talked to did, or if they hadn't personally had an experience in their own home, they're either their neighbors or a family member had an accident. And some of them had burns, some of them had lost property or had damages. One mentor we talked to had to take one of their children to the hospital because of bad burns. And so it's a very real reality for many people who don't have access to safe energy resources.
So this picture is of Jane, an RC we worked with in Gulu, which is in northern Uganda. And she is helping one of her solar sister entrepreneurs make a sale. And this was kind of out of the blue during or right before one of our meetings. It was really inspirational. She just kind of like sat down and started talking to this guy, and 2 minutes later he was buying a solar lamp. I don't know how she does it. And so in their sales pitches, another thing they kind of bring up is the monetary savings of solar. And so kerosene is kind of, it's like a short-term solution to a real long-term problem, which is energy poverty. And people need to continuously buy kerosene on a weekly basis. And solar is a one-time purchase, and then once you have it, energy from the sun is free. And so getting people to realize this hurdle, to get them to make this one-time payment, which may seem like a big deal at first, but then it pays itself off not only in monetary savings, but in the quality of life improvements, is not as easy as you might think. They need to sit down and have long conversations with them, and it ends up that a lot of the times the women are the best at selling these because they can relate to other women and kind of bring up the benefits that it has for their children. And so that's one reason why Solar Sister is a woman-based organization, because they end up being some of the best saleswomen. One customer Jane had was Hilda. She is a cake maker and designer in Gulu, Uganda. And this picture was taken and stitched together by our very own Emily Albee in the audience. On the right is Hilda's daughter designing these cakes, which has a very intricate pattern. The top left is a hut that is in the same village that the cakes are designed in, and the bottom left is obviously the cake. Hilda uses solar to expand her business. In the picture on the right, you can see is a solar light, the Sun King. The solar light really allows her to keep her business running longer hours because she doesn't have to worry about the fumes having it around her children who work in the business, and she doesn't have to pay extra money if she wants to have the light running longer at night. And so this allows her to make more cakes, gain more customers, and make more money. And she also has a catering business, which she runs on the side of her cake-making business, which she does after she finishes her job as a teacher. And she loves the solar lights for her catering business because she needs to travel to neighboring villages to cater for events like introductions, weddings, and funerals. And she notes the difference between solar and kerosene in the brightness and the portability, because they need to be careful when moving around kerosene lanterns because there's dangers of them tipping over, spilling, setting fires. And with the solar lights, they can do all their dishes and finish up their work at night and do it easily because the lights are just so much brighter, and it gives them that opportunity to kind of have another aspect to their business that they wouldn't have without solar. another example of business run from solar is that one of the women we interviewed said that she started selling phone charging out of her own home because her solar light has a phone charging station, and in general, people would have to travel to the center of the town and charge their phone there and then travel back. And so she charges them less money, and they have to spend less time. And so it's just a benefit to her. She has income coming in, and it's a benefit to them because they save time and money. And so this is just a perfect example of how solar has enabled women to expand a business.
That was one more cool example you could talk about from, I was going to move on with Kevin, Betty with the white ants.
Oh, yeah.
We talked to one solar system entrepreneur, and so she used her solar light in the most unique way we saw the whole summer. She there's a brief season in Uganda every year where white ants like, flood the villages everywhere. They're like flying, I don't even know how to compare them with, they're bugs, basically, and Ugandans roast them and eat them, and it's like a delicacy, everyone loves it. So basically they are attracted to the light, and so she takes her light out at night, and she catches them by like the bucket full, so she can sell them and make quite a bit of money because she has a solar light that's really bright.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's another great example. And so this kind of leads me to my point of output versus outcome. So the output is just one solar light, but the outcome can range in so many different ways. For someone who just needs it to let their kid read at night, it's just the outcome is that their child will receive a better education. For the case of Hilda, the outcome is that she can run her business. Her children are working in the business, seeing the benefits that the money coming in provides. The white ant, Betty, the outcome is that she can catch thousands of bugs at night and cook them and sell them to her community. And so there's just so many different ways that one solar light can benefit so many different people. And so another benefit that comes with this is the internal empowerment of women. A lot of the solar sister entrepreneurs we talk to, they would say, we would ask them what their favorite part of being involved in Solar Sister is, and the answer we expected and the answer we got a lot was the money they would save from solar light and the money they would make from selling the lanterns. But a large majority would also say that they loved coming to the monthly meetings and being able to talk to other women about their lives, and they were just so much more confident walking around their community and talking to people because they had a conversation starter. They were so passionate about solar because they'd seen the benefits. They wanted to spread the benefits to their friends and family, and so this kind of internal empowerment is another way that solar can benefit. And Natalie has a story with solar in the form of a hearing aid.
Yeah, I was just really inspired by seeing how the lives of these individuals could change dramatically after receiving a hearing aid. Like going back to what Kevin was talking about, yes, it's one hearing aid, but the outcomes were, immeasurable in all aspects of their lives. So we were working out of Sao Paulo, which is this huge, busy, chaotic city, and now these individuals could ride public transportation on their own. They felt comfortable navigating their way through the city. They could attend religious ceremonies. They could hear the music and the dancing. That's a huge part of the culture of Brazil. And so they had this sense of inclusion. I think Catherine and Miles can both speak to the enthusiasm that some of the individuals had to talk with us. So we would communicate with them partially through talking or through texting. We would text something to them in English and they would respond. And it was just this real sense of community that I think they were very they felt probably very blessed to be a part of because of their ability to communicate. And so there was a lot of internal empowerment that these individuals are feeling by their ability to hear and be part of the community.
And so this, these are two pictures of groups that we met with on our trip to Gulu. The one in the upper right is an Amani group. we met with. And then the one on the left is a group in Lira. They're both in the same region. And they were, granted that they were in the same area, the interactions we had with them were extremely different. The Imani group, when we got there, they were very quiet and shy, and we didn't really have any great conversations with them. And granted, there might have been a larger language barrier there, but you could still tell just from the body language that they were not extremely outgoing and social. And whereas the Lira group, as soon as we got there, like one step out of the van, we were getting hugs all around from everyone we met. And they just were so excited to talk to us and hear our stories and tell us stories about themselves. And when talking with David O'Connor, the higher up in Solar Sister that we were working with, he was saying that there's a lot of opportunity for the Lear group. A lot of women there could grow and be promoted in the organization. And so just they were both given the same opportunity, approached by the same woman, Jane, but they kind of embraced the opportunity in such different ways based on their social skills. So the question I had, is it more important to focus on women's social or economic empowerment? And by social, I mean increasing their self-confidence, their autonomy, confidence in their decision-making.
I think they both link to one another. I think if you promote economic development, there's a chance for social development. So it's tough to say which one would be the best, absolutely. But I think they kind of go hand in hand in some way.
Yeah, so I have an example. So Anudeep's curriculum focuses on workplace readiness a lot. So that means we're taking students, people from rural areas in India, and maybe preparing them for a career in IT in Calcutta, which is like bustling and there's big buildings and things like that. So the curriculum can be pretty basic things like this is a Western toilet, this is how you use an elevator, this is what you should wear to work, you know, a collared shirt and slacks. This is what it means to be on time to work. And so without those social skills, I think it would be pretty hard to get those students connected to employment in the IT sector. So that's kind of a testament to focusing on the social skills, because even if they were connected to employment, if they were lacking those skills, they would have a hard time.
I kind of feel like it's a cultural kind of difference where, like, if it's more of an economic or a social aspect of it, because in some cultures, by having more of the economic part and bringing in more finances, you're then better able to socially promote yourselves. And in others, you need that social goal to begin to develop economically, and then, you know, it's a reverse cycle. It'll come back to the promotion of the social benefit. So I think it's kind of, I feel like it's a cultural difference. It depends on where the culture is at the current time and where women and everybody stands on.
Out
That's great. So in my work with Solar Sister, we saw the empowerment through solar energy, but also from the income the women earned from selling the lights. So Lauren is now going to talk about income earning as a form of women's empowerment.
Yeah, so here as a woman, I can apply for jobs, I can pursue a career as long as I'm qualified and they want me. So why is my reality so different than what we see in the developing world? So I'm going to be talking about what hinders women from earning income. So here are some photos of the rural communities that we visited in India with Anyadeep and I Merit. So you can see there's kind of like green landscapes hinting that it's a very agricultural community. We see a very traditional family in a conservative village in the outskirts of India, the outskirts of Calcutta, and then two Anyadeep students in a rural area called Namkana. So connecting women to income earning opportunities is much more ambiguous than just giving a woman some materials to start a business or giving her access to an already established business sector. This is because of social constructs, limitations, traditional gender roles, and other factors that are reality in rural India and much of the developing world. The livelihoods of base of the pyramid populations are very much gendered. So I think all of us that were in the fellowship can attest to the fact that we see women mostly in roles of being a housewife or just more domestic roles based on tradition. So the enterprises that I worked with this past summer on UDEEP and iMerit are committed to developing the potential of rural populations, especially focusing on women, by providing livelihood opportunities. So they really need to understand the cultural context when strategizing about how best to train these populations, how best to connect them to employment. And the social enterprises that we all worked with encounter patterns, kind of things that they see being repeated in societies that must inform their strategy. So in much of the developing world, we see trends of girls leaving their homes to go live with their husband's family. I know this is definitely the case in India. Often they will move out of the home at a very young age when they get married and move in with their in-laws. And in this way, it kind of relieves the family of the woman of a financial burden, because the longer that she's living at home, that's money that the family is spending. And so the reality is that a family might be less likely to invest in the human capital of a daughter, knowing that she's going to get married quite young and then go live with her husband's family. In this case, families in the developing world might be more likely to invest in the human capital of their sons. So invest in their like health and well-being, in their education, knowing that the family will receive returns if the son becomes successful in business or in some sort of job. We've also seen that there are societies with very strong beliefs that women should not leave the home. For example, the picture of the city you can see there with the bright blue mosque. It's a very traditional village, and here the women are not allowed to leave the borders of the town unless accompanied by a man, which would be someone in the family or their husband. So as you can imagine, this really limits their access to income-earning opportunities because they can't work outside. And there's not really an infrastructure for women to work even within the town. So in these kind of cases, it's possible that the family might see that the social cost of the woman leaving the home and kind of leaving the duties that they're expected to do at home outweighs the benefit of an income that they might bring in. And then also, greater female labor force participation creates incentives for investing in education and well-being of a daughter. And we really saw that in India, especially in this community. We saw families that kind of abandoned their previous beliefs that women shouldn't be working outside of the home once they saw that their daughter was bringing in more money than anyone else in the family. And kind of slowly but surely, ideologies are changing about the value of women and really their potential. So another rural reality is that access to the formal job market, both for men and women, is very limited in rural areas. So even when there are opportunities for income, it's very informal, like day labor, laying bricks, you know, things like that. So many social enterprises are now focusing on unlocking the potential that rural communities already have, especially women. So they're recognizing that, yes, maybe women have been limited and maybe they have been in housewife roles, and because of their wide-ranging responsibilities that they've had in those roles, like being productive and having community duties and tasks, they have a broader range of skills to take from when kind of developing them into income earners. So really seeing the potential that women have and going from there. So these are photos of women that have been trained by OnUDeep and then either employed by iMerit, its sister company doing IT work, or in outside companies in Calcutta in the kind of IT district. So you can see the landscapes in this sector 5 of the city where all the business stuff takes place is very different than the rural areas. So given that most of the world's poor are women, out of the kind of bottom billion that are earning less than a dollar a day, that's 70% that are women. According to the stat that I shared earlier, it's very clear that it's not that these women aren't working. It's not like those 70% are not working. They're being very productive, carrying out very essential tasks for the community, but they're not receiving returns on their work. So they're doing 2/3 of the world's working hours, but not really receiving returns. So there's a need for jobs that provide income. And that's what social enterprises are trying to address. They see a need to build women's assets, reduce their vulnerabilities, something that Natalie and Laura both talked about, and tackling self-identified problems. So this is the idea that social enterprises need to really know where the women are coming from and ask, you know, what do you want? What can we do for you? And I think for OnUDeep and iMerit, over and over again, they heard livelihoods, livelihoods, livelihoods. And then the ultimate goal, of course, is to empower not only economically, but for life. Because we've seen that empowerment can increase a woman's bargaining power within her home. So give her a voice. Maybe husband or other family members will kind of give her decision more weight, knowing that her income affects their family. And as Natalie talked about, an increased household income, like a healthier mother, maybe a more educated mother, someone who's bringing in money, means healthier children, and all of that kind of diffuses to reach greater impact. So it's really important to study, like, how will social enterprises approach this? How are we going to empower women? What OnUDeep and iMerit are seeing is that because there's such a lack of opportunities in the rural areas, we're seeing increasing numbers of migration to the cities. So these women, for example, may have come from rural areas and then migrated to find work. So that might be the quickest way to move out of poverty, but it also disrupts the social fabric. So in India and many parts of the developing world, the family unit is very tight, and it's important to keep that together. So while iMerit and OnUDeep really tried to make migrating as comfortable as possible, if that's the case, they will set you up to live with people from your own area, and you know their workplace readiness curriculum tries to prepare people for kind of the shock that's coming when you move to a big city. They're also strategizing about how to halt urban migration so that people don't have to move, making opportunities available in the rural areas to keep families together. So they're also developing rural entrepreneurs to make that a reality, starting your own businesses in local communities. One example of this is a community we visited called Harindanga. This is the OnUDeep Center there. And here they're teaching women how to be tailors so that they can open their own shops locally. And this is really important because we heard from a lot of the women that their husbands are making an income, but it's not sufficient for their family. One of the women said, you know, say we need 5 rupees today. My husband brings in 3. Where did those other 2 rupees come from? So they're really taking it into their own hands to employ themselves and do something about it. So we saw a lot of smiling, empowered women there. They're just starting their training, and then they'll be able to stay in their local communities close to their families and also contribute to their family's well-being. So this approach that OnUDeep and iMerit have taken, as well as other social enterprises, recognizes that livelihoods are more holistic. So they go beyond just material assets. Yes, women need income, but it also is non-material well-being. And it involves political, cultural, and social aspects as well. We've seen that getting women involved in the labor force is an effective approach to lifting communities out of poverty. And something that I really appreciated about the enterprises we worked with was that they're not seeing poor people or women as passive victims, which I think has been the case sometimes with like charity or NGOs maybe, but as active and proactive people that have a role to play in creating their own future. So it's not focusing on what poor people lack, but saying like, hey, they have these skills or they have this potential and going from there. So an example of how that approach has worked for some people is that Musaral, the same girl that is paying now for her brother's tuition as well as her own, because she has income, she is now making the choice to educate herself. She just decided she wants to go to college and she's paying for that. So that's showing that there's an opportunity for mobility. It's not just getting one job and calling it good. She is continually developing herself, and that's because of the initial potential that was unlocked. So what we're seeing, especially in Metis Bruce, but around the rural areas, is that the marriage age is actually going up, as women are seeing more in their futures than just becoming getting married young and becoming a housewife. We heard over and over again that women are feeling self-independent, that they can make choices and that their voice means something. And then women becoming entrepreneurs is a really incredible step as well in these rural areas. We're seeing that it's changing the way that women look at themselves, at their place in their own communities, and their place in the world. So something that I had been thinking a lot about, especially being in Metis Bruce, where the women aren't allowed to leave the town unless accompanied by a man, is should social enterprises approach empowerment as a means for enhancing the lives of women within the status quo or as a mechanism for transforming the whole society? So right now, Ani Deep and Aymer are empowering women but still realizing that they cannot really leave the borders of Metis Bruce. So is that a good approach, or should social enterprises be aiming to really transform the society so maybe women can leave the borders if they want to and work outside?
I think it's tough to change the status quo of a billion people. I think it's more important to, I guess, work within the current culture and the current ideas of society instead of having one social enterprise or even numerous social enterprises try to change the structure of society and try to break longstanding tradition.
Yeah, I think another point is, although certain aspects of society might be constraining, they could also be what's familiar and comforting to a woman. So maybe she doesn't necessarily want to leave her comfort zone. So, you know, she would be very receptive to having opportunities within her own village so that she wouldn't have to give up the familiarity of her home, her family, you know, what she's grown up with. So it's nice to have both options.
Lizzie?
You know, you're choosing younger people over older people, you're choosing women over men. I wonder what your criteria are by which you do that. If you're from Santa Clara, we should believe in compassion. So if you believe in compassion, then maybe you would serve people who had better needs, and then just determining what those needs are, that's a whole set of criteria that you're making up. Driver's seat more when it comes to some of these things. So that's probably not at all what she said.
absolutely. So maybe social enterprises, they don't have a place in the radical social change.
I'm not saying that. I'm thinking that it's a little more complicated.
Perhaps maybe people within those communities are the ones that are starting something to affect change.
Yeah, I see this is what's happening. You know, I'd like to put those people in management positions just as fast as I possibly can, and then assume that they're going to fail. But some of them won't, and these things will be good for them all. But I'm a manager guy, so that's
okay. So we're going to wrap it up. Thank you so much, everyone, for being here. If you have any more questions, we can stick around. Yeah, thank you.
The Center for Science, Technology, and Society, accelerating global innovation-based entrepreneurship in service to humanity.
For more information on the center, visit www.scu.edu/social-benefit.